By many measures, there's ample evidence of shifting gender roles in America regarding food. Circling back to examine the many ways food and femininity come together in women's lives in 2015 is the endeavor of a new scholarly book entitled Food and Femininity. Joining me is co-author Kate Kerins, Assistant Professor of Childhood Studies at Rutgers University Camden. Kate, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, by invoking that name in the title, Food and Femininity, if you were to take it all the way back to that first wave, your book cites the quote from Betty Friedan in The Feminist Mystique, 1963, where she critiqued the idea of the happy housewife. Obviously, we're invoking more contemporary standards of feminism.
It's an interesting context. I think today, you know, many would remark that when we turn on food TV, we're just as likely to see a man cooking. Many of us probably have friends who are men who identify as foodies and who enjoy cooking. But we find even in this context where food isn't so explicitly linked to femininity, the vast majority of what we call food work, so the everyday work of planning meals, shopping, cooking, cleaning up, continues to be performed primarily by women.
Though that has certainly evolved too since the mid-60s. So much food is now purchased outside and consumed outside of the kitchen or home.
Absolutely. But we also are in a context where food is seen as intensely important in our social, cultural, and political lives. So one of the reasons why we were inspired to do this research is because we wanted to see how people were negotiating the immense pressures surrounding food. So invitations to buy local, shop at your farmer's market, teach your children where their food comes from, try out new home-cooked recipes. And we find that even, as you say, that we're past the sort of 1950s figure of the housewife, food still remains intensely connected to femininity.
So those pressures are inordinately then felt by women more than men.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I think is really important to come out of this research is that we find that, for instance, pressures surrounding what's sometimes referred to as ethical consumption. So thinking about the social and environmental implications of your food shopping practices, that because those are put on individual consumers, those individual consumers often tend to be women. So when we say that we have the responsibility to create a more sustainable, healthy food future, we are often putting that responsibility on individual women who are negotiating these pressures within their everyday food lives.
The book also examines economic implications, whether one has the means to A, afford, and B, have access to what we now consider healthy foods.
Absolutely. So we're not the first to suggest that, you know, the idea of quote unquote voting with your dollar assumes that you have enough economic resources to vote. But what we want to contribute to that conversation is that while class is a factor here, we can see gender and class working together so that working class and poor women are under a particular amount of pressure. And in our research, we found that that was often experienced emotionally. So a sense of guilt, possibly shame and frustration that there was a particular kind of gold standard of food shopping and also mothering that was out of reach for the low-income consumer.
A lot of the research was done in the context of assembling focus groups. How was that put together?
Yeah, so we started with focus groups that we conducted within existing social networks. So we would have one person who volunteered to host a focus group because this was someone who was interested in food. And we asked that first participant to invite four or five friends or acquaintances over to have a discussion about food. And my colleague, Jose Johnston, and I would come and we would bring, you know, treats from a local bakery and the host would serve tea and we would have a kind of friendly conversation over a couple of hours around food. And part of our reasoning behind organizing the focus groups this way was the hope that these conversations could be useful for participants outside the boundaries of our research. So for instance, in one of the focus groups, one of the women at the end was saying, this was so helpful having these discussions. You know, I think we should have a monthly food night where we get together and cook meals and talk about food issues. But while it was a kind of relaxed and supportive setting, you know, it wasn't all sort of laughter and good feelings. Because while food can be a site of pleasure and joy and a way of expressing love and carrying on cultural traditions, it also, as I said, generates a lot of feelings of stress and guilt. And those focus group settings were also ones where women supported each other as they shared the kinds of struggles that they were facing around food. For instance, feeding a quote-unquote picky eater, a child who wouldn't eat the things that were prepared for dinner, or being worried that they weren't properly informed in order to make the most environmentally conscious food purchases, feeling bombarded by competing information about what it is to be a healthy consumer, for instance. So these were also kind of collaborative settings in which to share those kinds of struggles and support each other around food.
I can't speak for your co-author, Josie, but I know for you this is the nexus of two research interests, that being feminist theory and the sociology of food. It's interesting. Your book also notes that this came out of a previous notion to talk more about consumer choices, the what, why, when, where, and how of obtaining food. How did it evolve to this?
Absolutely. So we didn't actually set out to study gender within this project. So as you said, feminist theory is an area of interest of mine, and José and I had written in the past about gender and food. But in this project, we were particularly interested in the way that individuals are negotiating food pressures and ideals in their everyday lives. So as I said, pressures around healthy eating, around ethical eating, negotiating economic constraints with, you know, time pressures and convenience, etc. And so when we set out to do the focus groups, we weren't just recruiting women, but we found that overwhelmingly those who volunteered to participate in our study, the vast majority were women. And then as the conversations continued, gender kept arising as an important issue within these discussions. So for instance, for many women within heterosexual relationships, they would talk about how even when they had a male partner or husband who was also interested in food and sometimes participated by doing some of the food shopping within their home, the woman was the one who often, you know, researched healthy food options, planned the meals for the week, wrote a very detailed shopping list that included not only what to buy but specific brands or locations to buy it, and then sent her partner off to do the shopping. So we found that this kind of what feminist scholars sometimes call invisible care work, or the emotional labor of what we often don't see but is an intense part of the work that goes into food, was predominantly being performed by women. So it was after having those first few conversations that we realized, huh, really what we need to do here is a study of food and femininity. And so the second portion of our study that involved one-on-one interviews were explicitly with women who viewed food as an important part of their identities. And that was how we recruited women for those one-on-one interviews.
Though by casting light on these heretofore invisible or less understood variables, one does come away with a sense of the undue pressure it puts on women. It can sound rather depressing.
Yeah, it's interesting because I recently was speaking about this book somewhere and someone made a similar comment that it, you know, and I think that comes through because one of our main goals is to highlight these inequalities that are often overlooked. So in a contemporary moment where, of course, there have been vast improvements in terms of gender equality, what we really want to highlight is, you know, food work is still a site of gender inequality. It is also an important site of class inequality. But it's not actually all a story of doom and gloom. You'll find in the book that there are stories of the intense pleasure and joy that comes from, you know, preparing food with friends, or carrying on traditions that have been passed down within the family, seeing food as a site of passing on cultural or ethnic traditions, or expressing love for, you know, for children, participating in a baking project for school. So there was a lot of pleasure and joy surrounding food, delicious food, and particularly food as a kind of site of connecting with others. But when I speak about the book, I think the thing that I'm most kind of adamant to emphasize is this issue of inequality, because I do think it's overlooked.
Do you have cause, though, to be hopeful in the face of such vested interests, whether it's agribusiness or capitalism in the consumer society and advertising and messaging and such?
Well, it's interesting that for you to ask that, because that was a question that we always ended our focus groups with. Because as you suggest, sometimes these conversations can get a bit gloomy. It can feel like, well, what can we do in the face of a seemingly broken food system? And when we asked about signs of hope around change, many of the people in our study pointed toward local community initiatives, things like community gardens or community kitchens that they saw as signs of hope within a troubled food system. And we do in the book talk to women food activists who are working at that kind of frontline activist work around food security or community gardens, but also at the policy level. And so I do think that there are folks who are doing really important work to create change, both at a local level and also at a policy level. So I do think that there are signs of hope, but we need to continue to do this sort of research and get the message out in order to suggest that an individual consumer approach to creating change in the food system won't be sufficient.
Was getting that message out specifically a focus of this book, which I found to be more of an academic or scholarly treatise?
Well, we hope that the book, while it certainly is academic, we've written it in a way that we hope is accessible and interesting to folks who are interested in food and gender issues outside the academy. So we've written it at a level that we think will be useful for undergraduate courses.
I understood it.
Great. Well, yeah, I mean, I often had a few different folks in mind, like friends who I know are interested in food issues and aren't academics themselves, and would try to be kind of thinking of a broader audience so that hopefully we're able to communicate beyond just the academy, beyond feminist scholars who are maybe already thinking about these issues, so that this can be a part of a broader conversation.
That your interests seem to be so diverse, is this a focus that you will specifically revisit, or are you off in a new direction?
Well, one of my key interests is, as you said, I'm in the Department of Childhood Studies. So I come to many of the interests in this book in thinking about gender inequality in relation to mothering and feeding children and the particular pressures that women face around feeding children. In my current research, I'm looking at the rise of educational initiatives to connect children to their food. So things like school gardens, but also there has been a kind of explosion of cookbooks for kids. We see many ways where we place our hopes in the future of food on children and young people. And I'm interested in this kind of conception of children and young people as the future promise or threat of our food system, right? So we see a lot of kind of emotionally charged conversations about kids these days are eating terrible things, they're making awful choices, and they're a threat to our nation's future. Or if we just get children planting food, then they are going to solve our economic problem. So I'm interested in how those kinds of conversations play out, but also how young people understand their own relationship to food, how school and community gardens can shape young people's relationship to the places that they live in, to each other, provide a sense of kind of familiarity and capacity around food. So that's the research that I'm engaged in now. And then in the future, I do want to continue to explore some of these connections around food and femininity in the context of girlhood. So among girls, how do we see these same sorts of gendered connections around food playing out? And how are they different when it's not in the context, for instance, of feeding a family?
So, Kate, certainly during this holiday season, there's ample evidence of tensions at times between the male-female gender role in preparing and hosting.
Absolutely. I think holiday meals are a time where we can see the kinds of intense emotions related to food playing out. So preparing a meal that expresses cultural traditions and brings family and friends together around the table can be a source of reward and an opportunity for women to gain a sense of satisfaction through their food work. But it also is an immense amount of work and pressure and can generate feelings of stress. So, you know, it might be an opportunity for folks to reflect on in their own families and their own gatherings, who is doing the majority of this food work. And as I mentioned earlier, not simply the very visible work of standing at the stovetop, but the kind of invisible labor of planning the meals, of preparing shopping lists, going and doing that shopping, also considering everyone's different taste preferences, making sure that folks are having a good time, right? There's a lot of emotional nutritional work that goes into holiday meals, and that work tends to be gendered. So the holiday season might be an opportunity to reflect upon the ways in which the division of labor around food within your own home.
Standing at that stovetop is just the very tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
Kate, thanks so much for shedding light on this very interesting and complex issue.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kate Cairns is Assistant Professor of Childhood Studies at Rutgers University, Camden.